Welcome to another episode of North American Deer Talk, where the fusion of facts and opinions become the education and entertainment for all. This is your host, Josh Newton, and we have another great show for you today. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of North American Deer Talk. Once again, we're on the podcast, we're on the video stream, we are everywhere just for you. It is April 14th, another lovely day here in North Central Pennsylvania. Got a couple quick items that I'd like to talk about. It's going to be a shorter than usual show, or at least I'll try to keep it that way. I have a tendency to kind of get out there and get into topics that I didn't plan on discussing. Would like to point out my lovely new PDFA hat. If you're on the video stream, we have some new swag over there in the Pennsylvania Deer Farmers Association office. You want to get a hat and rep the PDFA, do that. We got some t-shirts, maybe a couple hoodies, things like that. So give Shelly over there a call and check those things out. So we had our PDFA fundraising event, the PA Deer and Outdoor Expo, this weekend. I had a great time. It was a great show. A lot of positive information was shared, and we had some good community and some good food. So the biggest takeaway for me from that event was I was able to share with all the people in attendance about the upcoming Chris Seabury research project that is going to, for lack of a better term, become a commercial entity for us. And basically that looks at the entire deer genome. You're able to map out your deer and then find out what its breeding value is in relationship to CWD susceptibility. I'll be working on a review or an overview of that presentation in the coming weeks and look forward to sharing that with you. Hopefully we'll have some basic graphs and slides. We don't have really all the information yet, but I'm excited to share that with you as I think it has a ton of value. And I personally believe it is the most important thing we have moving forward in the deer industry today. So you're going to be hearing a lot more of that from me to all of you. You could take it for what it's worth, but I think as an industry, at least from a breeding side of things, it's the most compelling thing that I've seen yet, and it needs our attention. So, with that, I want to cover one topic that was a listener call-in topic, and I'm not going to name that particular individual, but hopefully he or she is listening, and I can answer this question here, and I think it'll have benefit. So it says, hey, I've been listening to your podcast and just heard the one where you said, do not turn over all of your ground in your pens at one time. May have listened to this a couple weeks ago and it was too late. What are some of the problems that could arise? Pretty much everybody that I've talked to told me that I need to turn over the deer in my pens. No one had ever done anything in the pens that I have as far as soil management, etc. And there had been deer on the property for over 15 years. Thought I was doing a good thing by turning over the soil. So I appreciate that question, and I think that it has some value and merit to discuss here. And it hopefully could benefit everyone. So there's a couple things. I think that turning over the soil generally is a good thing. Anytime we can expose air and sunlight to our soil, that's a net positive. What I meant by turning over the soil in an entire pen is most of us are limited on space, and that requires us to have deer in those particular pastures on a regular basis. So if you turned, let's just say you had, whatever, four pens, right? And each one of those pens had a few deer apiece in it. And you were going to maintain, I don't know, whatever. Let's just say it's an acre pen and there's, 10 deer in there. If you were going to turn over that entire 1 acre pen with those 10 deer and keep those 10 deer on there, number one, it would be a little bit more difficult to, have stuff grow there with those animals on there. But that initial bacteria, if there had been animals on that for, a decent amount of time, that increase in bacteria that presents itself by turning the ground over can cause some issues, especially this time of year and going into fawning. So ideally if you had to have deer in that pen, what I'd like to see is like a third or a half turned over in the case of a half, every 2 years, and in the case of a third, maybe once a year do a third of the pen, and then do a third of that pen the next year, and then the other third the following year, and kind of keep that rotation. That's if you want to put that input or that effort into doing that. I don't think that's a bad thing. Now, when we're turning over our ground, we have to decide what's the intent of that. Obviously, there's time and labor that's involved in that, and those things are expensive. You have your material, whether that be fertilizer, seed, various soil improvements. You have to have the equipment to do it, so on and so forth. That's all a commitment, and we'll put commitment in air quotes, and we'll say that commitment is valued with a dollar, and all those inputs go in and they have this dollar figure. So it may, it may cost you $500, per third a pen or whatever that is, right? So you have to calculate that. For me, I think what would be ideal is if you could turn over a pen in the fall, early in the fall, maybe fertilize and plant it, let it sit dormant all winter, and then pop some deer back in there in the spring. I think that would be a good idea. I kind of like, this is my lack of experience in this particular area. So I'm going to say something, and others that are much better at their, pasture improvements and management be like, this guy's crazy, right? That's certainly a possibility. But I would much rather see the ground cracked open in March, April, May, whatever that is for your geographical location, fertilized, cultipacked and planted, however you're going to do that, and let that sit over the summer, grow, maybe do a cutting or something like that, and just let that rain and heat, et cetera, kind of work that soil over and grow some crop in there, get a good root base, and then add animals in the fall. Ideally, when we talk about, or at least to me, when we talk about these types of improvements, I think many of us have, a reason why we're doing that. And it's typically to keep fawns alive, we'll say, or make sure our fawns flourish. Adult deer have a much more robust immune system and are able to more easily adapt to environments than the, the younger animals. So, we can, quote unquote, get away with more with the adult animals. I like to see a little bit more stable environment, and there's other things that go into play, but like a little bit more stable environment for the fawns to go into. So, generally speaking, keep your animal density down. We're going to say this, I think I'm going to try to say this once on every show for the time period of infinity. And that is keep pen density low, keep animal numbers low. And almost all these other things go away. Your improvements become different. your inputs become different, and the overall, you know, carrying cost of your farm is greatly reduced. And ideally, I'd like to see us move towards that type of environment. Now, every farm is a little bit different, but I think we can work within our means to make that a reality. And we're going to be covering that more in upcoming shows, talking about, you know, inputs, outputs, and management strategies that I think, you know, we can all implement to some degree on our farms. And, you know, whether you choose to use these or not, that's entirely up to you. But I think we can kind of strategize here and have some good conversation about what that looks like and what are really the long-term impacts, not only for our farms individually, but on a state-by-state basis and a national basis moving forward. That conversation needs to happen. So, you know, you're probably listening like, hey Josh, how do we go from soil improvement or soil management to what are things the industry can do long term? You know, I apologize for that, but it's something that consistently weighs on my mind, and I think it's really important for us to keep having that conversation and keep moving that needle, at least in the deer farm world and, you know, the deer ranching world. We have an opportunity in the next coming years to really focus on our efforts as an industry at large to promote it. And that doesn't mean, you know, start more, you know, we'll call them traditional deer farms. That means, number one, having more opportunities for hunting properties to be established, to continue to promote and develop those businesses to, you know, various landholders and stakeholders in all states, and showcase what private deer management is. For me, right, for me personally, I look at how I got into this, and it was through hunting. You know, it was through bow hunting as a kid, basically, and that love for deer and that interaction that I had in the woods, you know, sitting in a climber every night, you know, trying to kill a deer with my bow. And, you know, I've gone down this route where I wanted more and more personal interaction with these animals, and that's how farming came to be. But ultimately, we stand on the backs of, you know, hunting, and it's important to realize that. And as soon as we start looking at our farmed operations and say, what can we do better to increase the accessibility of hunting ranches in our states, I think the better off we are long term. I think that message is a good one, not only for us internally, but from a public perception standpoint. Again, I got off on a tangent. I didn't want to talk about this today, but just some thoughts on that. So, second topic. This was brought up in a thread on the North American Deer Talk Facebook group. And on that Facebook group, if you're not, just a side note, if you're not on the, if you're on Facebook and you're not part of the North American Deer Talk group, head on over there, hit that member request. We'll get you in there, and appreciate, you know, any posts or comments you want to throw up there. You want to hear something, you want to ask a question, throw it up there. It's a place where you can keep track of all the, you know, the listings and postings, whether it be the YouTube channel and or the podcast. And it's a great way to keep up with all the things that we have going on at North American Deer Talk. This show is going to continue to expand and grow. I'm hoping to set up some interviews so you don't have to listen to me yap all the time directly to you, and provide some additional value to you all. But one of the questions was posed over there from my buddy Greg, shout out. And the general question was, is how do we breed for specific traits? The one that he had mentioned was tine length. So I'll attempt to, in my limited capacity here, attempt to try to discuss this with you. I think from a simplified version, we have to identify, number one, the traits that we find compelling or important to us in our operations. So Greg had mentioned time length, right? If we have this consistency of establishing time length, how do we do that? How do we maintain it? Generation over generation, how do we breed that into our herds, et cetera? So, the only way that I know of to consistently do something is through line breeding. And some people are like glazing over and they're like, oh my gosh, he's going to talk about line breeding again. Can we just get away from this? Can you just tell us what deer to breed or what you think are good deer or whatever? Okay. That's one route to go. I would rather use this opportunity to talk about more of something in the abstract and from a theoretical perspective rather than a specific deer, though I will probably mention some specific deer here for example purposes. So, time length. How do we breed consistently for time length? Now, this is not new. This is not a theory. You know, this has been done in practice. This has been done in other animal industries. The question is are you committed to doing it? Ask yourself that question. What am I willing to sacrifice in the short term for the long term benefit of my herd? This is not a short game. I have made, this will be my 22nd year having fawns, right? And I've made so many mistakes over the years as far as my breedings go. And yet I've learned so much that I think I'm the best breeder that I can be today. And that's still just a small little piece of what I think that I can do in the future. So knowing that and saying that, those mistakes, they'll teach you things. And they'll teach you, number one, is to have a very, very low time preference, right? A low time preference. In other words, this isn't going to happen in, a couple years or in, one or two generations. And in the deer world, we're looking at a generation, as, 18 months of time. And that's at the almost absolute fastest pace. That's the most consistent pace. So let me define that for you. If you have a doe that's born, it's going to take, 18 months, 2 years, till she even has fawns. And that would be the next generation. Yes, you can get some doe fawns to breed, and they will have fawns. The first year they will breed at 7 months old, 8 months old, and then have fawns at 12 months old, something like that, 13 months old, whatever. But that I would say that's not having 25 to 40% of your fawns breed is not consistent. Having upwards of 90% of your does breed is. That's something that we can count on and we can use as a metric. Okay. We're getting there. We're getting to time length. I'm coming. So, the point was is you got to be patient, okay? The second thing is all of your deer are not valuable. They are in some respect. You're going to learn from them. But you have to be willing to use the most compelling tool that we have as far as selection goes, and that's culling. Everybody's like, oh my gosh, you want us to kill animals. Well, do you want to be successful in producing these traits or not? Because in every other animal industry, that is the method. Now, we're fortunate, again, I'll come back to the hunting. We're fortunate that the value of our animals is not simply based on the value of the carcass or the meat production. We have this other, class of value, and that is trophy. Now, we don't see that specifically in the females, but certainly in the males. And that's what differentiates the cervid species, specifically whitetail, which is by far the largest driver of economic impact in the hunting world in North America, period, end stop. It just is. There's 30 million whitetails in North America, right? So with that said, calling is incredibly important. So how do we use that call tool? Okay, so we have, let's just say we start with a doe, okay? And this doe is bred to a buck. And we get offspring. Let's say they're bucks. They grow out what you would consider or what you would say is something that you really like. Like these deer are just incredibly nice looking. You want more of them. Okay? Obviously, this doe and this buck have... The doe and the buck that you bred together have some sort of lineage, right? You would hope you would know that. I think we're to the stage now where, like, everybody knows the pedigrees of their animals, okay? How do we make more of those? How do we, quote-unquote, do that again? Well, you can make the same cross, right? You can cross that same doe with that same buck. And you can get that, you know, same offspring that has on paper, you know, the same quote unquote DNA. Now, when you analyze those parents, they're all going to match up. That's just one little component. But if you looked deeper and you looked at, you know, the entire genome, their DNA is it has similarities, but it's very different. Like all these animals are really, really unique. Outside of identical twins, which I think is much more of a rarity, these animals are just different, you know, multiple eggs, multiple sperm kind of thing. So they're going to have different, bits of DNA. But by doing this, right, by creating, multiple generations of offspring with the same parentage, we are limiting some of the DNA that these animals have, or at least, making animals that are closer to the same than not. Okay, so we have these similar animals. You need to bring those animals together and breed. So people are like, what? You're going to take full brothers and full sisters and breed them together? Yes. If these animals are selected, right, for superior breeding, they meet all the physical requirements of the selection that you have put forth. If you want to hear more about selection, I think it's an interesting episode. There was an episode, a few back, called selection or genetic selection or something like that. Listen to that and, you can hear more on that. I can't get into it today because I just don't have the time. I'd love to, but I don't have the time. But breeding those animals together then limits the genes again. Now, yes, you've heard that, when you breed together like animals, you're going to get all the bad and all the good. Okay, well, if the animals let's just say you're looking at them, physically looking at them, and they all look really good, and they exhibit the traits you want, you're going to get those in mass, right? You're going to see those. They kind of double up. That's important, right? And I'm going to come back to the timeline here. I didn't forget. If you see traits that are exhibited that are negative, what do? Well, you can try to fix them, right? You can try to fix them with other blood, other breedings, or you can just get rid of them. Now, depending on the size of your herd, if you have the numbers, getting rid of some does is pretty easy. You can make up for your numbers, and the economic incentive is a component that I think we all have to think about, but we're just talking genes right now. Okay. So that's one cross, right? Is the brother sister cross. And then we have the half brother, half sister cross, where, same mom, you know, different dads, or same dad, different moms, right? And then there's whether you have to look at that and say, okay, there's paternal influence. Does the dad hold the traits that we can see? Or there's that maternal influence. Now, the maternal influence, obviously, is more challenging for us to be represented visually out in the field because does don't have antlers. So what are we looking at? We're looking at that doe's parents, dad, right? Granddad, because that's the only real visual representation if we're breeding for antlers, right? Now, we can go down that road another time too, but breeding for antlers only is bad. Don't do that. You'll end up with a deer with the antlers you want and none of the other traits that are important. Body size, conformation, reproduction, all those things. You know, health, longevity, etc. So don't do that. All right. Now, there's the when we look at that doe, we can also look at her offspring and see what kind of traits she throws. You'll start seeing similarities in those offspring, the male offspring. Now, if they're all from different dads, it becomes a little more challenging because they have influence too. And then you have to make an assessment of the selection and, you know, heredity of that particular sire on that doe. And it's challenging, right? And you have to have a really open mind to that. Now, with that said, a lot of times by the time you figure out if a doe is quote unquote good, she's old. she's real old. So what I think, and I'm this is kind of a new thought to me. What I'm thinking is that once I've identified, you know, the female, the one that I think is just really kick ass, I would try to, you know, instill her into the herd as much as I could. And that, you know, I think one of the great tools that we have is collecting embryos. Controversial topic, maybe not, I don't know, but we can talk about that another time too. But I think that's a good tool for preserving those genetics. And it may be, you know, a one or two time opportunity on proven does as opposed to just collecting all these does up front when they're young and, you know, whatever. So, let's jump on to the next cross. Okay. So we then have, this doe potentially that we've identified that's really good. And maybe she has, you know, we're basing that on some of these sons. So we look at one son and that son is exceptional. Well, what do you do with that son? You breed him back to his mom. People are like, what? You're breeding the son back to the mom? Yes. Yes. You want to figure out where those genetics came from? You have to do it. Okay. Well, what happens if the offspring come out and they're not good? Call? We talked about that. You got to call. Or you can try to fix it with other genetics, right? As soon as you bring other genetics into that line, You're diffusing what's been built up there, right? From a genetic standpoint. Okay. Now, what's the final cross? The final cross is taking on the paternal side and saying, okay, we have the sire. He's excellent. I'm going to breed his daughters back to him. Okay. Same cross as son to mom, but in the inverse, right? So those are really the primary crosses. And I would say full brother, full sister, daughter to father, son to mom. These are inbreeding techniques. And you're going to get a much more dense, you know, stacking of similar genes by doing this in a single generation. Now, there's some more tame options, but when you do that, there's diversity, right? And diversity is going to be the enemy of great, in my opinion. So when we start looking at, you know, cousins, aunts, uncles, you know, that gets into, and I would even say half brother, half sister, that is going to get into, you know, more line breeding. So back to the original question, how do I get tine length into my herd? Well, you can scour around, right? You can scour around for a buck that is already line bred or inbred and is expressing the genetics that you want, i.e. tine length. And most likely, if you find a deer that has the tine length you're looking for, let's say it's 15 or 16 inches and he's expressing that, the likelihood that he is going to pass that down is much better than, let's just say, a stacked buck or a non-related buck where it's just, you know, buck on doe, buck on doe, buck on doe, buck on doe, and they're all, you know, fairly unrelated genetics, right? When you do that and you start incorporating that particular buck in that has this tine length, you need to then look to take his offspring, male and female, especially male and only males that are exhibiting above your criteria of tine length, right? So more than 15 inches of tine. And then you can breed them to all of those daughters. So that'd be, you know, half brother, half sister crosses. And then the selection process continues. This is all about you looking at your deer, understanding what is there, referencing the genetics on paper to evaluate what you should be seeing it, and then doing something with it. So again, you have to select, you got to select good animals. You have to select the best animals. Only the superior animals should be breeding. And that's, I mean, I don't know how else to say it. It's hard. You know, we look at these deer and they're out of so-and-so and we've spent this money on AI, et cetera. And if they just don't make the grade for whatever you're looking at,
then they just have to go. There's no other way to look at it. They have to be called from the herd. With that, I think we're going to wrap up. It sounds like a good place to wrap up. Appreciate everyone joining us here on this episode of North American Deer Talk. Remember, you can find us on Instagram at Cervid Solutions, or you can check out my personal handle. That's at the Deer Wizard. Yes, the Deer Wizard. But in all seriousness, make sure you follow us over there. The Cervid Solutions page is great. I try to do regular videos there with tips for your farm, the daily ramble, maybe just some of my more abbreviated thoughts on whatever we have going on that day. Also, check out the Cervid Solutions Facebook page, the North American Deer Talk Facebook group. Trying to build that community out over there a little bit, get input from all of you on, you know, various questions, things like that. It's I think building out to be a good community. Just would love to get some feedback from you guys there. So feel free to post up over there. I have an open thread right now. Post a picture of any deer related item, thing, whatever, and maybe a question or comment that you have on the show, and I will try to answer it here. I'd like to do those weekly, or maybe every 2 weeks, where we just kind of group up, much like today. You know, there's two questions that I wanted to address or answer or talk about, and kind of go from there. So there's that. Also, I have been trying to get this YouTube thing going, and I don't know if I don't have enough storage on my computer or what, but my video keeps cutting out. I am working on that. So if you watch the videos over on YouTube, I apologize. I'm going to get my act together. I promise it will be soon. We just cut a bunch of instructional and educational videos, kind of short things, you know, a minute, maybe two tops, for the Cervid Solutions website. So those should be coming, kind of filtering into the ecosystem soon. You know, they're going to cover all sorts of what I think are kind of interesting things. And hopefully they help you with the experience over there at CervidSolutions.com. But if you could find it in the kindness of your heart to share this out with your fellow deer farmers and ranchers. I am excited to try to keep growing the show. And if you find it valuable or you think somebody else would, tell them to head over to the various platforms, like, subscribe, etc. And with that, we'll see you on another episode of North American Deer Talk. Take care.